Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from CRU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. Equifax, Inc. reported this past week that more than 8% of homeowners were behind 30 days or more on their mortgage loans, up 4.4% from December 2009 and 21% from last January, Reuters reported. In January, one in every 409 U.S. housing units received a foreclosure filing, up 15% from the year earlier month, according to RealtyTrack, based in Irvine, California. There is a large segment of homes that are going to enter foreclosure in the next 3 to 6 months, which then puts more pressure on home prices by adding to supply, according to Equifax. And next up, you may have seen the URL freecreditreport.com or a commercial. Well, according to Huffington Post, freecreditreport.com commercials to be curbed, but not till September. And from the article, among the merciful provisions of the landmark credit card reform signed into law last year is the requirement that purveyors of phony free credit reports put the following admission in all their ads. Quote, this is not the free credit report provided by the federal law, end quote. While credit card companies have had 9 months from May 2009 until February 22nd of this year to come up with a business model less reliant on abusing customers, Experian, the credit reporting company behind the freecreditreport.com, will have until September before it has to inject some honesty into its ubiquitous TV spots. The ads, in case you somehow haven't seen them, say you can get a free credit report if you go to freecreditreport.com. You can, but only if you enroll in a $14.95 a month credit monitoring service and then cancel it within a week. The site for truly free credit reports is www.annualcreditreport.com. And I'm going to repeat that. www.annualcreditreport.com. The Federal Trade Commission has won more than $1 million in settlements over the years from Experian for its deceptive advertising. In February, a Wisconsin woman hit the company with a class action lawsuit. Online advertisements for free credit reports will have new disclosure requirements as of April 1st. However, the FTC said it was reasonable to give TV advertisers more time. The commission believes that a delay in the effective date for the wording of the disclosure in television and radio advertisements is warranted beyond April 2010, writes the FTC in the text of its Federal Register notice. As one commenter noted, compliance with the required interim disclosures, followed by compliance with the different final disclosures, will impose additional costs for television and radio advertisers. It would require advertisers and advertising agencies to create two sets of commercials, one set to run beginning on February 22, 2010, and the second to run when the rule goes into effect. This would substantially and unnecessarily increase the cost to provide television and radio commercials. So the bottom line is freecreditreport.com is essentially not free, and don't go for it.
go to annualcreditreport.com. And next, here's a couple of stories similar to thousands playing out across the country and tens of thousands more to probably come. Elizabeth Warren on the coming commercial real estate crisis, 3,000 community banks at risk. And this is all from Mike Mish Shedlock at Global Economics Analysis, blogspot.com. Now, according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, they're reporting Brookdale Mall sold at auction for big markdown. The Brookdale Center went on the auction block at a sheriff's foreclosure sale last week, netting just one bid of $12.5 million for the shopping mall's lenders. The bid for Brookdale Mall, HHLLC, was well below the $51.8 million owed on a $54.2 million mortgage by the property owners, Brooks Mall Properties of Coral Gables, Florida. Sears is its sole remaining anchor. In the last couple of years, Macy's, Barnes & Noble, and Mervyn's have all closed their stores in that mall. The mall has also lost other key tenants, such as Steve & Barry's. Almost 60% of the space is vacant, according to recent figures from Northmark. And this is really pointing to the commercial real estate crisis, which is on the horizon. A mortgage crisis like the one that has devastated homeowners is enveloping the nation's office and retail buildings, and few places are likely to be hit as hard as Washington, D.C. The foreclosure wave is likely to swamp many smaller community banks across the country and many well-known properties, including Washington's Mayflower Hotel and the Boulevard at the Capitol Center in Largo, which are at risk, industry analysts say. There has been an enormous bubble in commercial real estate, and it has to come down, said Elizabeth Warren, chairman of the Congressional Oversight Panel, the watchdog created by Congress to monitor the financial bailout. She continued, there will be significant bankruptcies among developers and significant failures among community banks. Nearly 3,000 community banks, 40% of the banking system, have a high proportion of commercial real estate loans relative to their capital, said Professor Warren, whose committee issued a report on commercial real estate last week. Every dollar they lose in commercial real estate is a dollar they can't use for small businesses, she said. Individuals who saw their home values drop in the residential mortgage crisis would not feel that kind of loss, but Warren said a large-scale failure would throw sand into the gears of economic recovery. So in Washington, the office vacancy rate stopped ballooning in the fourth quarter of last year for the first time since the first quarter of 2006, according to CoStar, although largely for an unfortunate reason. The space was being filled mainly by office workers hired to handle the plethora of bankruptcy filings and workouts of borrowers who need to renegotiate bad debt. So just do the math. There is a strong potential to see 1,000 commercial real estate bank failures in the next couple of years unless Congress acts to bail them out. Bernanke is unlikely to lift a finger as his concern is for the big boys, who he will support at any and all costs. Of course, no banks should be bailed out, and two wrongs do not make a right. Thus, the correct direction is to let failed banks fail. The last thing we need is further bank zombification. And this is according to Mike Mish Shedlock of globaleconomicsanalysis.blogspot.com. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond.
Now for the second part of the show, we have been looking at and reading from studying The Two Income Trap, which is a book by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's great leaders in helping people who are having problems with their finances. And it is essentially a book about why the middle class parents are going broke. It has been seen as a breakthrough book that provide solutions to the biggest crisis families face today. And we even see some comments about the book from Time magazine. They say it is a startling account of the elusiveness of the American dream. Jeff Madrick of the New York Times said, more clearly than anyone else, the authors have shown how little attention the nation and our government have paid to the way Americans really live. And from Paul Krugman, he said, it's a wonderful book, revelatory, makes a good case that the epidemic of bankruptcy is not about people being irresponsible. And that is the point we have been discussing in the last couple of shows, the idea of the immoral debtor, which Professor Warren has concluded is a myth. And I'd like to start out with my credit that the thoughts, ideas, examples, and text used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. And I do highly recommend their books, All You're Worth and The Two Income Trap. You can also go to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look under Life and Debt to listen to all of the past shows that were produced to help you deal with and to understand your debt concerns. Now, jumping back to the issue of the myth of the immoral debtor, last week we were talking about bad timing. Professor Warren had done a statistical analysis, and it runs contrary to most families' assessment of the risks that they face. You think with two incomes, most parents believe that they have built in some self-insurance against layoffs or medical problems. Turns out not to be the case, that they are in fact wrong. Two-income families are more likely to file bankruptcy than their one-income counterparts. And also, dual-income families who have filed for bankruptcy are also more likely to cite job loss or injury as the reason for their financial collapse, which Professor Warren says is really painful irony. The family sends both workers into the workforce in order to buffer themselves against the terrible wrenches of a changing economy, but they've just made themselves more vulnerable to those very wrenches, twice as likely, as a matter of fact. But what about the other reason? Family breakup, huge medical bills. Now, you may think that these kinds of problems really don't seem to have anything to do with the two-income trap where both parents are working. Over time, both those risks went up too, which proved to be very, very bad timing for the middle-class family that had let go of its safety net, which, as we've discussed, is really one of the parents at home, which historically was the mom. But let's consider medical bills. As we know, when we just go to the newspapers nowadays, the ranks of uninsured people are swelling, and the problem has seeped well into the middle class. In the year 2001 alone, 1.4 million Americans lost their health insurance, and this is going up year after year. The curious point is that even with these kinds of numbers, a large percentage of the people actually have good incomes. Experts calculate that an individual is now 49% more likely to be without health insurance than a generation ago, and these statistics, I have to point out, were actually made before this new recession that is plaguing the American economy. And you know that the medical costs are escalating, and as is not surprising, a growing number of families who file bankruptcy are filing in the wake of a catastrophic medical bill. And this is common knowledge among us bankruptcy attorneys. Anecdotal, but nonetheless the truth. From 1980 to 2000, the number of families declaring bankruptcy in the wake of a serious illness multiplied more than 20-fold or 2,000%. Then also we look at the demographics, which pinch the family, because the number of Americans aged 85 and older, who are those
most likely to need daily assistance grew at a rate more than 6 times faster than that of the under 65 population. So that's another problem. Then there's declining birth rate and a higher divorce rate, which compounds the entire situation. Today, elderly have fewer children to share the burden, and more are alone after a divorce. So you add this together, and families with minor children are now almost twice as likely to be providing assistance to elderly parents than receiving it. Next point is that hospitals and insurance companies really are in a conspiracy to cut costs. What they want to do is dismiss patients, and the phrase is quicker and sicker.
When we look at the numbers, 1 in 3 individuals require at-home care after being discharged from the hospital at a minimum. So that means that millions of families have to step into the situation, take care of some sick relative every year. I know this very, very much in terms of my practice. I see it happening all the time with elderly, with kids, or should I say the children of the elderly who have had some economic problems, and maybe the elderly do have the money and then no longer have it to help the family. But this is a common kind of financial crisis due to the very highly supportive family bonding. But if we have all the adults in the family committed to the workplace, well, that's kind of too bad. There's nobody around to help. What can you do there? Well, the bankruptcy statistics really tell the story. Dual earner couples are nearly twice as likely as single breadwinner families to file for bankruptcy because of work lost as a result of an illness in the family. So there's nothing immoral at all about this kind of situation. The law is allowing somebody to file bankruptcy because, frankly, they really need it due to some circumstance out of their control. So that's illness. But what about divorce? Well, that's also another calamity hitting today's two-income families, and with greater frequency than the single breadwinner families. Looking at the statistics during the 70s of the last century, a single earner couple had about the same chances of splitting up as a dual income couple. Now, by the 1990s, a working wife was 40% more likely to divorce than her stay-at-home counterpart. No one really knew why the difference emerged. Sociologists offered a number of competing theories, mostly related to the stress of working and bringing up kids. It's very stressful at home. The two-earner couple has less time for each other, and on and on. Some people say that it's just the stay-at-home wife's traditional gender role being embraced, perhaps making a smoother relationship. Although feminist scholars offer their own explanation, arguing that working wives see themselves as less dependent on their husbands for financial support and are freer to leave a bad relationship. But all those grim facts and rationales might be true or not. The bottom line is that the modern two-income family faces a greater likelihood of divorce than the one-income family from a generation ago. And then we also looked at the fact that there's a very hidden issue here, the couples who never marry. Over the past 25 or 35 years, the number of children whose mothers have never married increased statistically by more than 400%. They may put down never married on the box on the census form, but they're not really single either. Since the 1970s, the number of unmarried couples rearing children has increased eightfold, according to Professor Warren. Cohabiting men and women represent more than 6% of all couples raising children, compared with less than 1% a generation ago. Although 6% may sound like a modest proportion, the odds that a child will live with a cohabiting parent
add up over time. According to one estimate, approximately 4 in 10 children will spend some time in a cohabiting family before they turn 16. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we've been talking about divorce rates and cohabiting relationships. So what does the rising divorce rate actually have to do with the cohabiting relationship? Well, cohabiting relationships share many of the financial characteristics of a marriage, since there are two adults to share expenses and responsibilities of running one household. When a cohabiting couple breaks up, the consequences are much like those when a married couple divorces. You have to find separate housing, there may be some joint obligations, and I see this lots and lots among people who are filing for bankruptcies. They have a lease or a mortgage that they both signed, or sometimes car payments or motorcycle payments here in Iowa. Now, these have to be resolved. If both the partners are the children's biological parents, then you have custody decisions and arrangements for visitation, child support. All this has to be worked out. But there's also the twist. The logistical consequences of splitting up may be the same as with a marriage, but the odds of breaking up are not. Cohabiting couples with children are more than twice as likely to split up as their married counterparts. Doesn't sound good. It makes it a frail situation for the families with children. As these unmarried parents go their separate ways, the number of families left without a second adult to share the burden continues to grow. So we add it all up. There's the list of ills: job loss, family breakup, medical problems. Those are brutal, but it may also appear a bit disjointed. After all, the divorce rate has nothing much to do with health insurance coverage. A corporate restructuring has no effect on the number of elderly folks who need help from their families. And this really is a very important point. When we read the newspapers, we watch a news show on television, we listen to the radio, and there's some crisis, the attention goes on one concentrated point at a time. One problem is in the spotlight, and that's it. It may be about the terrible problems of the uninsured or the story of divorce trends. And then, of course, there's the academic and expert reinforcement of this kind of approach. And this is, frankly, the way the legal system often works. It's one issue segregated at a time. We have one highly focused area of expertise in the academic world, and they usually write articles and hold talk shows about one specific category of calamity, and this often happens in trying to deal with legal issues. The brain segregates out one thing and jumps on that as the critical, crucial thing. But human beings, frankly, and a group of human beings, a family, do not experience risks in neatly segmented boxes. We live integrated lives. Whether they give it much thought or not, they all live under the shadow of multiple dangers. A woman could lose her job, she could be struck with a devastating illness, her marriage could go bad, and her parents could grow too feeble to care for themselves, and it could all happen at the same time. There is no law that requires these disasters to be polite enough to wait until the previous one is resolved, obviously, and the family has recovered before a new one brings about a new calamity. It just doesn't work that way. Another thing that Elizabeth Warren points out is that one disaster triggers another. A layoff may leave a family without health insurance, which increases the exposure to an exorbitant medical bill, and a job loss and the stress associated with that, as we're seeing across the country today, may actually lead to divorce. As finances deteriorate, couples tend to fight more, they increase their chances that they're going to split up. The statistics show that among families in bankruptcy, nearly half report two of three problems: job loss, medical problems, or family breakup. And about 1 in 13 were hit by all three. So Professor Warren concludes that we have no statistical proof of the old wives' tales that bad things happen in threes, but there is ample evidence that disasters really do follow disasters. So let's get back to the point of the myth of the immoral debtor. So we've gone through it, and there's very little evidence that morals are declining, and so much evidence that the family risks are increasing. Now, why does this myth of the immoral debtor persist? Why don't we collectively agree that in most cases, financial misfortune is simply a matter of bad luck, bad karma, call it what you want, misfortune, and that this concept of declining morals have nothing to do with the long lines at the bankruptcy courts? Professor Warren says that perhaps the myth survives because it provides a much-needed comfort in a dangerous world. There's nothing more glamorous or mysterious about the events that conspire to drive families into financial ruin. They are remarkably common, ordinary, and painful. For many people, reading about a litany of disasters will bring back memories that are disturbing, sometimes bitter, and sometimes very, very personal. Just think about that embarrassing moment when a friend was escorted out of the office during the latest round of company layoffs. Or that nightmare moment when the call came from the hospital emergency room. Or that very sad day when the spouse told the other that it was over. Move out. This list of these kinds of catastrophic or tragic moments kept people awake at night. So it may not have even happened, but we just know about them. What if I lose my job? What if my spouse loses her job? What if grandma gets Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease and I have to help out? The possibility that a family, which is our family, faces a rapidly growing chance of disaster is really too painful to think about, especially if there seems to be very little way to avoid it. The myth of the immoral debtor nourishes the unspoken idea that families who have lost their financial footing are a tainted group, some other who are different from the rest of us. If we can believe that those in serious trouble are morally suspect, then it's easier to glance away from the harsh dangers of everyday life. According to the professor, this myth supports a comforting illusion that the rest of us are safely distanced from financial collapse, making it possible to avoid that terrifying moment of connection with someone caught in a financial disaster. That frightening, "there but for the grace of God go I," realization. And next week, we will continue with an ounce of prevention. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.